sunny, highs in the low to mid 60s. Now back to All Things Considered.
These drug cartels are not using force against us because they disagree with us politically, because they want to harm the country, because they have some ideological agenda. They just want to make money.
President Trump is waging a military campaign against the drug trade. Is that legal?
For Monday, October 6th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Ahead this hour, the rise of Larry Ellison.
He's a tech billionaire and a soon-to-be media mogul.
The potential to persuade Americans, if you own CBS News, TikTok, and CNN, is incredible, and I think it's historically unprecedented.
Also, comedian Fred Armisen has a new album. It's called 100 Sound Effects.
Which is exactly what it sounds like.
I wanted to treat it with seriousness, as opposed to just, hey, I'm going to put together these sounds. I really wanted to book time at an actual studio.
And why some winemakers are reporting their worst year in decades.
That's ahead. First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. President Trump's deployment of National Guard troops in Chicago can continue, at least for now. Federal Judge April Perry is giving the administration 2 days to respond to Illinois' lawsuit challenging the deployment. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker says Trump is causing chaos to create the pretext for invoking the Insurrection Act. That's the 18th century law that allows a president to use the U.S. military against Americans on U.S. soil under certain conditions. Trump says he's willing to go there.
Well, I'd do it if it was necessary. So far, it hasn't been necessary, but we have an Insurrection Act for a reason. If I had to enact it, I'd do that. If people were being killed and courts were holding us up, or governors or mayors were holding us up, sure, I'd do that. I mean, I want to make sure that people aren't killed. We have to make sure that our cities are safe.
Trump argues troops are needed to help fight crime and to ensure that federal agents can enforce immigration laws in the city. Negotiators from Israel and Hamas are holding talks in Egypt today on a possible end to the war in Gaza. President Trump and Arab countries are urging both sides to reach a deal, and soon, NPR's Kerry Kahn reports, there are still major sticking points.
President Trump warned Hamas if it doesn't cede power and release all 48 hostages, dead and alive, it faces, quote, obliteration. Trump also told Israel to pause its bombing of Gaza. Israeli airstrikes over the weekend killed dozens, according to Gaza health officials. Arab mediators are pressuring Hamas to negotiate at a time when it is facing great losses on the battlefield. Israel and the U.S. are demanding Hamas release all hostages quickly. Hamas says it needs time to locate the dead. There are disputes over which Palestinian prisoners Israel release in exchange for the hostages, how Hamas will disarm and relinquish power, and over Israeli troop withdrawal from Gaza. Kerry Kahn, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
President Trump and Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva spoke over the phone today in a first move to discuss commercial relations after the steep tariffs the U.S. imposed on Brazil. From Rio, Julia Garnero reports the conversation lasted half an hour.
On his social media site, President Trump said the call had focused mostly on economy and trade between the U.S. and Brazil, and that he and President Lula would get together in the not-too-distant future. He wrote, quote, "I enjoyed the call. Our countries will do very well together." This follows a brief exchange at the UN General Assembly, where President Trump said he and Lula had, quote, "excellent chemistry" after months of strained relations. According to the Brazilian government, President Lula called for Trump to reduce the 40% tax surcharge on Brazilian goods and for sanctions on Brazilian authorities to be lifted. For NPR News, I'm Julia Carneiro in Rio.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The French are waiting to see what President Emmanuel Macron will do after his latest prime minister resigned this morning. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports France has been plunged into political crisis and Macron is increasingly isolated.
Speaking after resigning, outgoing Prime Minister Sébastien Lecornu told the nation it was too difficult to govern with a fractured parliament where no party has an absolute majority, yet all refuse compromise. Lecornu was the fourth premier named by Macron since he dissolved parliament a year and a half ago and lost his majority. The National Assembly is dominated by the far right and leftist factions who say the president is not listening to the voters and has lost legitimacy given his extremely low poll numbers. Analysts say Macron has three options: name a prime minister from the larger mainstream left, dissolve parliament and call new legislative elections, or step down and let the French people choose a new president. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
A growing share of Americans say they are using AI in their jobs. According to a new study from Pew Research Center, 21% of U.S. workers say at least some of their work is done with AI. That's up from 16% roughly a year ago. Workers younger than 50 and workers with a bachelor's degree or more education are among with the most likely to use AI in their job. And Taylor Swift's 12th studio album, The Life of a Showgirl, sold 2.7 million copies in album sales in the first day in the U.S. Swift broke the record for most first-week sales, which she set with her 2024 album, The Tortured Poets Department. I'm Ryland Barton. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It is 6 minutes past the hour, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Dine out for United Way of Bemidji now through Friday, October 10th. Restaurants throughout the area will donate a portion of their sales to support the community. Find more details at UnitedWayBemidji.org. And coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team. Now we'll take you back to All Things Considered.
Considered from NPR News, I'm Scott Detrow.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has ordered the Illinois National Guard to deploy at least 300 soldiers to guard federal facilities, also to protect ICE agents and other federal officers in Chicago. Now, that order calls for the troops to deploy for 60 days. That is according to a memo obtained by NPR. Meanwhile, another 200 Texas National Guard troops are set to arrive in Illinois tonight to assist in protecting facilities where Hegseth says violent demonstrations are occurring. NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman is tracking all this. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Catch us up on where things stand. Are there any guard troops on the streets in Chicago yet?
No, not yet. I'm told by a U.S. official not authorized to speak that those Illinois guard troops are now gathering at a central location, but they'll still need medical screening, you know, personnel checks, training on crowd control before they head out. So it could be later this week or next before they hit the streets in Chicago. Now, as far as the Texas troops, no word on that from officials I'm talking with about when or if they'll be on the streets.
Well, and Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker says they won't be on the streets if he has anything to do with it. He says the guard is not needed. He has filed a federal lawsuit to try to stop President Trump from sending the National Guard in Chicago.
Yeah, that's right. He's saying the guard troops are being taken over by the Trump administration, sent to Chicago for what the suit says is, quote, flimsy pretext. Now, there are some protests in Chicago against ICE and its facility, and a woman carrying a weapon was shot Saturday morning by Border Patrol agents and later taken to custody by the FBI. Border Patrol said while on patrol, they were rammed by vehicles and boxed in by 10 cars. Now, Pritzker, he held a press conference today and talked about why guard troops are not needed, that the local police can handle protests, and sending in the guard will only undermine public safety and just inflame the situation. Let's listen.
There is no invasion here. There is no insurrection here. And local and state law enforcement are on the job and managing what they need to.
Tom Bowman, let me shift our attention farther west to Oregon, Portland, Oregon. President Trump also wants the National Guard there. Again, he says, to protect an ICE facility and ICE agents. Where does that stand?
Right. Well, a federal judge has blocked the deployment of 200 Oregon Guard troops to Portland, as well as another 200 Guard troops from Texas, still another 200 from California. And the judge cited the administration's rationale in her ruling. It's called Section 12406, Title 10 of the U.S. Code.
What is Title 10?
Well, it says a president does have the power to take control of a state's guard. It's called federalizing the guard for three reasons. One, an invasion or threat of invasion by a foreign power. Two, a rebellion or danger of a rebellion against the authority of the United States. And three, the president is unable to execute the laws of the United States with the forces at hand, meaning, you know, let's say local law enforcement. So do the protests in Chicago and Portland rise to that level? The Trump administration says they do. Again, Pritzker Metzger calls it all flimsy. A federal judge in Portland agrees. So the bottom line, Mary Louise, no National Guard troops are on the streets yet, and we're off to federal appeals courts.
Just briefly, it's always helpful to look at precedent in things like this. There have been times in the past, right, when a president has taken control of a state guard or the governor has said, look, we do need to call out the guard.
Yeah, it's on rare occasions for a president. Think of the civil rights era when presidents, you know, Eisenhower, Kennedy and Johnson took control of a state guard to enforce civil rights laws, making sure African-American kids can go to school. And for the governors, serious riots. 1992, Los Angeles after the Rodney King beating, and in Minneapolis after George Floyd's killing 5 years ago. But again, rare.
Thank you, Tom.
You're welcome.
And NPR's Tom Bowman.
We're going to talk about another area where President Trump's use of the military is facing big legal questions. This is strikes on alleged drug smuggling boats. We got more details late last week about the administration's legal justification for the attacks in the form of a notification sent to Congress and obtained by NPR. It says that the president has determined the U.S. is in armed conflict with unspecified drug cartels. That argument has found many critics, including law professor John Yoo. He was a lawyer in the Bush administration's Justice Department and played a key role in developing the legal justification for the war on terror after 9/11, as well as the ways the U.S. government interrogated people captured during that war. John Yoo, welcome to the program.
Hi, great to be here.
I want to start with something that you wrote recently. You wrote that war invokes powers too extraordinary to be used against crime. Walk me through what those powers are and why it's important to you and to many legal scholars to keep them separate.
Our Constitution, our laws distinguish between war and crime. For example, if you are arrested by the government because you're suspected of a crime, you get all the protections of the Bill of Rights. You have the right to be presented to a judge, to learn the charges against you, to get the Miranda warnings, a lawyer, ultimately be tried by a jury before you're sentenced. Think of war. We try to kill the enemy or detain members of the enemy if they can't fight. You don't have to have evidence. You don't present it to a judge. You don't go out and arrest people and give them a trial because you're fighting a foreign enemy that threatens a national security. So the most important problem is identifying who's really an enemy versus what's part of just a perpetual social problem we have.
I mean, arguably, illegal drugs and overdoses have killed way more people than terror attacks in the United States. Should that be part of the consideration? Or do you think there's a clear cut, this is a standard crime, even if it has deadly effects, and this is a war?
You're definitely right. The harms that our country suffers from crime are definitely higher. I think last year or the last 2 years, we've lost about 100,000 a year, maybe 200,000 every 2 years just to fentanyl and other drug overdoses, which is way more than the casualties in Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, or Afghanistan. But that the harm to the country itself does not define whether something's war or crime. You could say murders inflict way more harm on the United States than a lot of the wars that we fought. But we don't use the military to fight murders at home. Instead, I think what you need to see is a foreign entity that is using force against the United States because of a political agenda, because of disagreement with our ideology, to take territory for political objectives.
Is that what to you is the main difference then between an international terrorist group like Al-Qaeda and a big drug trafficking group? Is it just the overall end goal that each of them has?
Yes, in part. So I was at the Justice Department, as you said, on 9/11, and we had to actually face the question that we really hadn't faced in the United States before, whether we could have a war against something that was other than another country. And we decided that Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups were much like a foreign country in the level of force they could use against us, why they used force against us for political reasons. I think that decision with drug cartels that are not connected, they're not fighting for Venezuela, for example, but just drug cartels, don't pass that test because they aren't using force against us because they disagree with us politically, because they want to harm the country, because they have some ideological agenda. They just want to make money.
The Trump White House is drawing a clear line between what it is doing here and what the Bush administration first articulated 20-some years ago and what the Obama administration in many ways continued as policy. And I'm wondering, as you have seen this played out and used in different ways, have you had any second thoughts about the standards that you and others put into place in the wake of 9/11?
I don't. And I'm not saying that we have perfect answers. You know, we were under a lot of pressure on September 11th itself while we were suffering attacks from Al-Qaeda. But the way we thought about it was, can we ever use the military against something other than a nation? And look, there were a lot of people in Congress and in the academy and media who were critical of that view. And that's why we went to Congress and within a week got an authorization to use military force. And we went to the Supreme Court when the very first detainees were captured out of Afghanistan, and the Supreme Court agreed. I think that's something that the Trump administration should do if they really, because I think they're going out way on a limb, way beyond what we did. They're going to have to get Congress to agree, and I think that would then have a big influence on the way the Supreme Court will view it when these cases start to come up later this year.
That is John Yoo, a law professor at the University of California, Berkeley. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Now, a remembrance for a British actress best known for on-screen snobbery.
Dame Patricia Routledge died last week. In the 1990s, she starred in the BBC TV show Keeping Up Appearances.
It's a sitcom about a middle-class woman named Hyacinth who is hell-bent on trying to convince people she's upper crust. She's always embellishing parts of her life, including the pronunciation of her last name,
which was spelled B-U-C-K-E-T. So, okay, she's Hyacinth Bucket. But of course, that was far too pedestrian for Hyacinth. As she made clear throughout the show's entire run, B-U-C-K-E-T is pronounced bouquet. In Routledge's hands, a woman who could have been insufferable was instead beloved and responsible for many laughs around the world.
Routledge got her start in theater at the Liverpool Playhouse. She performed in London's West End and later on Broadway, winning an Olivier Award and a Tony. She was also a member of the Royal Shakespeare Company, and audiences got to see her on the big screen in To Sir With Love, starring Sidney Poitier.
In the latter part of her career, as she rose to global TV prominence, Routledge alternated between stage and screen. In 2017, Queen Elizabeth II made her a Dame Commander in honor of her services to theater and charity.
Patricia Routledge died at her home in Chichester, England, on Friday at the age of 96.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:18, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE, People Power Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 5:30 is going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE, KBXE news team. We receive support from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu available at rapidsbrewingco.com. The Virginia Public Library offers a genealogy assistance program the second Thursday of the month at 4 p.m. Whether you're just starting out or fine-tuning your research, all are welcome. Kotaska Community Action in Grand Rapids is collecting gently used kids' Halloween costumes now until October 15th. Costumes may be dropped at the former Murphy Elementary building from 9 to 4 weekdays. It's National Fire Prevention Week now through October 11th, and the Minnesota DNR offers guidelines for wildfire prevention. Keep campfires small and manageable, and always have plenty of water nearby. Hold off on burning large debris piles until there is 3 inches of snow cover. Always check if a burning permit is needed at mndnr.gov/burning permit. If you see a wildfire, move to a safe location and call 911. The Grand Rapids Area Community Foundation announces the Itasca Area 100 Plus Women Who Care Giving Circle Monday, October 13th at Timberlake Lodge. Registration begins at 5 p.m. and the program begins at 5:30. Attendees each contribute $100, and nonprofits can be nominated to receive the collective donation. Find more information and register on Facebook. Itasca Pride hosts the occasion, an adult prom, Friday, October 10th. Tickets include dinner, dancing, and transportation. Find more info at itascapride.org.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Subaru. Subaru has donated more than $70 million to support the adoption, rescue, transport, and health of over 700,000 animals. Learn more at Subaru.com/pets. From Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Comedian Fred Armisen has just put out a new album. It is called 100 Sound Effects, and that's exactly what it is. Over the years, fans of Armisen's comedy have come to expect the unexpected. Everything from entire shows spoofing obscure documentaries to some of Saturday Night Live's quirkiest characters. So, while on one hand it might seem unusual for the comedian to put out a sound effects album, on the other hand, what took him so long? When we spoke about the album, it became clear pretty quickly that for Fred Armisen, this kind of comedy was serious business.
A sound effects record is something that I felt like was missing in my life. I didn't hear of any new releases. And I just remember in my life, you know, there would just be like a Halloween record that would come out,
yeah,
or sound effects CDs that would come out. And it was just fun just looking through all the titles and everything and then just, you know, sampling some of them. And it was just like a feeling of like, oh, whatever happened to those? And then it just occurred to me, I was like, I'll make one.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you remember listening to those Halloween ones? I feel like I remember Halloween sound effects CDs for sure.
Yes. And I remember there were a lot of human voices on them, you know, like the all that kind of thing and creaking of wood and chains and all that stuff.
Is that why you put some haunted house things in here? I think haunted house, ghost going upstairs, but the door is locked.
Hmm?
Haunted house ghost, but nobody is home.
Huh. There's nobody here.
Yeah, I wanted to do more, but I think that the haunted house ones were harder than I thought they would be.
How's that?
When I listen back to the originals, they're pretty in-depth. Like, there are many layers to them.
Yeah. You dedicated this album to the late producer Steve Albini, who did help you put this together. Can you tell me what some of those conversations were about what you wanted to do and how you could do it?
Well, Steve loved what he did. He loved microphones and he loved all the technology behind it. So I told him this idea and I asked him for advice on what studios to go to. He's in Chicago, so I couldn't record there, but he was really into it. He made phone calls on my behalf without me asking him to do that. He called Dave Grohl, and I ended up recording at the Foo Fighters studios. And I wanted to treat it with seriousness as opposed to just, hey, I'm going to put together these sounds. I really wanted to book time at an actual studio. And that's also because of Steve, meaning like, don't just throw it away. Let's really do this.
Did you start thinking, what could I make in a studio? Did you just think, what would be a funny sound? Did you just think, like, here's a sound I come across? Like, how did we get this list?
I think that when I've listened to sound effects records, whenever there are audience sound effects, you know, booing, clapping, cheering, those are the first ones I always went to. Mostly because I was like, wow, they really got a group together to do applause and laughing. So I thought, what about expanding on that? What about some that are a little more detailed, like supportive booing? A Romanian rock crowd. As I've traveled around, crowds are different when they ask for an encore. So I thought Eastern Europe, so I did a sort of Romanian crowd kind of stomping a little more.
Did you just have like a notebook or a notes app filled with sound effects ideas for a while?
It was a notebook. It's almost like a sketch pad, like, oh, I'll just have a couple ideas, but then it got really dense. And then there are many that I just couldn't do. There are many that I tried that as soon as I started leaning into the comedy of it, it didn't work as well.
Can you give me an example of that?
Some of those music ones, had my voice on them. There was one that, for example, tuning a guitar, and for some reason, it's still out of tune. It's just something that happens to some musicians. Then I had my own reaction to it. And I thought, well, if you're going to use this as a sound effect, you don't need someone's voice on top of it. So I had to sort of scale back a little bit and treat them kind of coldly.
Yeah.
And then some were pretty layered, like all the airplane ones are really layered with sounds of ambient noise.
Okay. Okay.
The sounds you hear of people chatting are me and a couple of other actors. You sort of take for granted how much sound happens on a flight.
It's a lot. Yeah. Can you tell me about one of these sound effects that is still making you laugh months later, that you're like, oh, that was a good one?
The ones related to film, there are some that are a well-reviewed movie, meaning like, you know, it's up for an Academy Award. The sound volume of household chores, like chopping vegetables and farm work, for me, it's always too loud in the mix.
Uh-huh.
So those movies seem to be saying, this is hard work. So I did one of a sort of wash bowl, and I'm washing clothes by hand. And then there's one of an important film. Because usually if someone says to you, like, hey, there's this really important film, they seem to be from the 1950s and from Italy.
Yes.
So I had a friend of mine record, she's from Italy, herself being like in a sort of town square, or you know, like in a town square where the window is open, someone's shouting out the window.
Andiamo tutti in piazza adesso, tutti in piazza. Chiudete le finestre.
There's a lot of really funny sound effects, but there are a lot of ones that seem more wistful or nostalgic, and a lot that have to do with travel.
To me, travel is sound. It's like when you check into a hotel, it's the feel and sound of doorknobs, you know, so in Europe, it's that lever as opposed to a doorknob. Even, I feel like the quality of doors is different there. Like, they're thicker. Like, I think those doors are like, it's like heavy wood. So it's those kinds of sounds, the sounds of, you know, elevator buttons, washing machines, dryers. Yeah, I guess it is nostalgic, and that's the fun part of travel.
Yeah. How do you envision people listening to this, interacting with this? Like, what's in your mind as you put this out there?
For this year, I hope it's fun. Like, people just sort of play it for their friends. Like, hey, did you hear this? And they play a couple tracks, and then they go on with their day. But I'm hoping that in, say, 10 years, someone does reach for it in a way that's like, I really actually need this sound of breaking glass.
Oh, don't worry about it. Those are cheap.
Especially, there are some that are the other side of a performer, meaning the audience is saying to the performer, hey, your mic is off.
The mic's not working.
Mic's off.
We can hear you fine.
You don't need it. You can just use your regular voice.
Yes. Sounds good.
So that's one that I'm like, that would be good for, you know, if you want to, you know, do the other side of a comedian or one person show person talking on stage, you could just use that for like, hey, your mic's not working.
I'm really tempted to like crack on my script paper and like do some sound effects right here. I don't know.
Do it.
Now I feel underwhelmed. I feel like
No, because you can title it. You could say radio host shaking a piece of paper.
I'm on my way. That is Fred Armisen, the actor, comedian, and musician on his new album, 100 Sound Effects, out now. Thank you so much for talking to us about this.
Thank you so much.
This is NPR News.
It is 5:29, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is the Up North Report. Pine River Market Square will hold an indoor growers and crafters market Saturday, October 11th from 10 to 2 at the Warehouse on Norway Avenue in Pine River. Local band Every Bird will provide live music. Now it's time for the Up North Report here on KAXE KBXE, People Powered Radio.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report.
three adults suffered injuries after a plane crash near the McGregor Airport in Aiken County. Chelsea Perkins has the details.
The Aiken County Sheriff's Office states first responders responded to the crash scene Sunday afternoon about a half mile southeast of the McGregor Airport. The initial investigation reveals that the plane, a Piper PA-28-140, lost power shortly after takeoff from the airport. The pilot attempted to return to the airport when the plane went down in a swampy area short of the runway. The plane is a small aircraft that typically can seat 2 to 4 occupants. One passenger was life-flighted for treatment, and 2 others were transported by ground to Riverwood Healthcare Center in Aiken. All 3 are being treated for injuries and are reportedly in stable condition. The occupants have been identified as Caden Brzezinski and Jocelyn Erlandson, both 23 from Ham Lake, and Wyatt Sherry, 22 of New Richmond, Wisconsin. Chelsea Perkins, KAXE News.
The state of Minnesota's lawsuit against Fleet Farm over firearms straw purchasing will proceed to trial despite Fleet Farm's attempt to dismiss the lawsuit. According to a news release, Attorney General Keith Ellison's office prevailed in federal court, with the judge rejecting a motion for a summary judgment. The retailer is accused of selling guns to straw purchasers despite red flags, such as multiple purchases of similar guns in a short period of time and large cash purchases of firearms. The lawsuit's claims against Fleet Farm include negligence, public nuisance, and violating the Minnesota Gun Control Act. The court highlighted the circumstances of Fleet Farm sales to 2 straw purchasers and how one of the guns Fleet Farm sold to Jerome Horton was used in a mass shooting at the Truck Park Bar in St. Paul. The 2021 shooting left 1 dead and 14 injured. A Fleet Farm sales manager in Blaine raised concerns to an internal firearms compliance employee about Horton's purchases in July 2021, but reportedly never heard back. Fleet Farm's 2 firearms compliance employees later provided a company training on suspicious sales activity using Fleet Farm's July 2021 sales of guns to Horton as an example of what should raise a red flag. The court will establish a trial date in the near future. Keith Ellison will be stopping by Bemidji this week for a community forum. The forum will be 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. Tuesday. The location will be made available before the event to those who register. Ellison is slated to speak about lawsuits filed against the federal government. Participants will be invited to share stories and concerns about actions taken at the federal level, according to a release. Ellison will also host a community forum in Brainerd on October 27th. Bemidji State University Alumni and Foundation is launching a new initiative to replant trees on campus. The Replant Our Roots campaign asks supporters to sponsor a new tree planting at $1,000 each. Full donations will be commemorated with a plaque, and donors will receive a sustainably sourced wooden thank you gift. The initiative aims to replant some of the hundreds of mature trees that came down in the June windstorm, some of which had been around since before Bemidji State started as a teacher's college in 1919. The Alumni and Foundation will accept smaller gifts toward the tree replanting, with donors invited to help plant them in spring 2026. More information on how to get involved is at bsualumni.org. The Cuyuna Regional Medical Center has announced some changes to its healthcare services for the Brainerd Lakes area. A new same-day clinic is slated to open by mid-2026 in Nisswa. The clinic will be located next to Schaefer's Foods. Additionally, CRMC plans to transition its home care and hospice delivery services to a new provider, Vivi. Vivi is a new name representing 2 legacy companies that merged in 2024, Knute Nelson and Walker Methodist. The transition is expected to be complete by the end of the year. The changes come with growing demand and shifting demographics, according to a news release. Other key investments for CRMC include a full-time neurologist and continued growth and access for rural patients to oncology services, which have seen a 43% increase in patient volume since 2023. That's it for the Up North Report. Find more of our stories at KAXE.org. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is sponsored by Woodland Bank, dedicated to serving local businesses, families, and nonprofits in our area since 1920. You can find more information online at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BritBox, committed to helping viewers to see it differently with British TV. With new original series like Code of Silence, about a deaf woman recruited as a lip reader in a high-stakes police investigation. Streaming at BritBox.com. And from Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Tech billionaire Larry Ellison and his family are poised to establish a media dynasty. In the past few months, Ellison and his son David have taken control of CBS News. President Trump tapped them to run TikTok, and they're set to make a bid for CNN's parent company. NPR's Bobby Allen looks at Larry Ellison's rise from cloud storage exec to soon-to-be media mogul.
Oracle is one of those tech companies that people often wonder, what exactly do they do again? Just ask George Polnizer. He's a former Oracle executive.
Earlier in my career, when I would tell people I was working for Oracle, they would go, oh, you know, the toothbrush company. And I was saying, you know, not Oral-B, Oracle.
Oracle's not in the toothbrush business, but to some, it's about just as exciting. They run the back end of the internet, hosting massive amounts of data in the cloud, helping governments, militaries, hospitals, and private companies make sense of the data. The data-hungry AI era has meant big business for Oracle. Here's Larry Ellison talking to investors last year.
You say, I really want to use AI. I want to take full advantage of AI. Well, you can't do it unless you get your data in order.
Since the AI boom, Oracle has seen its stock price more than double. That has sent the personal wealth of Larry Ellison soaring. He briefly knocked Elon Musk off the top spot as the world's richest person on the Bloomberg Billionaires Index, which adds to his showy and flamboyant nature. Ellison, who is 81, owns nearly an entire Hawaiian island. He's a competitive yacht racer, and he owns a fighter jet. Former Oracle executive Polnizer says Ellison was like this even before he became a confidant of President Trump.
I think Larry is an iconoclast. He's always been known as a swashbuckling visionary in many respects. He has, I think, an incredible appetite for access to power.
After November 2020, court records show Ellison was on a call with Trump supporters sharing ideas about how to undermine the result of the election. From that point on, Ellison has gotten closer and closer with Trump, which has helped win government approval for the Ellisons of Paramount Global, gave Oracle a leg up in the TikTok deal, and they hope gives them an advantage in a future bid for Warner Brothers Discovery. Michael Sokolow, a media historian at the University of Maine, says controlling a dominant social media platform and a television network could give the Ellisons even more sway than the Murdoch family.
The potential to persuade Americans if you owned CBS News, TikTok, and CNN at one point is incredible, and I think it's historically unprecedented.
Now the question is, when the deals are done, will Larry Ellison and his son David move CBS, CNN, and TikTok to the right? Analysts I spoke to say it's possible, but it'll be balanced against not alienating each media company's existing audience. What's unquestionable, though, is that those deals are a big data play, says former Oracle executive Polnizer.
He may be looking primarily at the value of the data and advertising revenue from harvesting that data.
The Ellisons didn't return requests for comment, but in remarks to investors last year, Larry Ellison fantasized about a society in which all things are under surveillance at all times, and that Oracle would be the steward of all the data.
The police will be on their best behavior because we're constantly watching and recording everything that's going on. Citizens will be on their best behavior because we're constantly recording and reporting everything that's going on.
The Ellison family's expected hold on media and entertainment data has drawn comparisons to how Vanderbilt's owned railroads and the Rockefellers controlled Standard Oil. But in the attention economy, that digital data could be even more valuable than railroads and oil. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
There's something beautiful about a big old tree, whether you come across it out in nature, camping or on a hike, or maybe just taking a walk, or maybe even in a yard. It makes you think, how old is it? How tall is it? Is this the biggest tree around? Well, in Maryland, there is an ongoing competition right now, which is all about finding some of the state's biggest trees. Jolie McCatherine is the vice chair of the Maryland Big Tree Program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Scott.
So the contest this year is new, but there is some history to the idea, right? Tell me about that.
Maryland actually was the founder of the Big Tree Programs, even the National Champion Tree Program. In 1925, the first state forester, Fred Besley, developed a measuring process for the trees. And he did a little contest in Maryland, send in your trees. And people did. And he continued doing it over the years. And so Maryland started it. So we're really proud of that.
You're bringing it back.
Bringing it back. And it's our 100th anniversary.
So tell me the rules here. How do you go about finding a big tree? What are the parameters? What's eligible? What's not eligible?
Okay. Well, the first thing in this particular contest is the tree has to be 15 feet in circumference or more.
Okay.
So the idea was to try and find more trees within state forests.
So specifically within state forests. What's your advice for people if they see a tree and they think this might be big enough to count?
To take a piece of string with you, wrap it around the trunk at 4.5 feet, and then mark it, knot it, and then take that home and measure it. So you don't have to carry a tape measure if it's, you know, too big or too heavy, but make sure you can get that circumference because that's going to be the minimum number we need for the circumference.
And what are you looking for? What's the overall point here? Is it just to get a better sense of the scope of older, bigger trees out there? Is it just to get people looking in this kind of way, in a way they might not notice these trees?
I think you've hit the nail on the head for both. I think it's really fun for people. Some people are tree hunters. Mm-hmm. I'm personally not a tree hunter. I'll go measure them. If I find one along the way, of course I'll measure it or take a look at it. But if somebody calls me or sends in from the website, I want to nominate a tree, then we will check it out. We'll get the basic circumference so it tells us whether you can even become a champion.
Do you have a sense what the range of ages in the Maryland forests are? How old are we talking? What's the extreme end?
Okay, we do not age them because of different growing conditions. People ask this all the time, and we might give them a range. We might say, you know, 2 to 250 years, but we don't know. Mm-hmm. We certainly don't want to core the tree and count the rings because that could cause way much damage to the tree.
Because that's the appeal, right? The idea that this living thing is that old.
What this thing has seen and been through.
Yeah.
And the most important rule of any champion tree you see is to touch it. If you can touch that bark and you can feel that tree having lived this long, it's an amazing feeling. It just, it brings me back to earth and I feel like I'm in a cathedral every time I touch one of those trees.
So you said you're not a tree hunter, but you clearly like trees.
Oh, absolutely. I'm doing this by choice.
What is your, do you have a specific favorite tree?
I do. And that's really hard, but I had to come up with one, and it's the English elm.
Okay.
It's called the Goshen elm. We have done a lot of research on this tree. We've measured it. We've turned it over to the National Arboretum for their input. And it is an English elm, so it's not native.
Mm-hmm.
We believe from the research it was brought over from Kent County, England.
Wow.
Now, we can't verify that, but that's what we believe by our past history on this tree.
So if people are interested in this, so they have to, one, go to a state forest in Maryland.
In this particular contest, yes.
Two, bring some string with them.
Yeah, it's a good idea.
Any other tips for how to adjust your eyes so that you're looking for a tree that might be eligible? Like, should they look down or up?
Up is always good. Most people don't look up, but it's the thickness that you're looking for. The circumference of that trunk is going to give it away.
Yeah.
And we are interested, really, if anybody's out searching, we are interested in any tree that's 300 points or more.
And by points, this is a scoring system of circumference and height and width and things like that?
Right. It's the circumference in inches, the height in feet, and 1/4 of the spread in feet.
Okay. You mentioned a cash prize before, but I don't think I know what the cash prize is. What are we talking here?
I don't remember. I thought it was $500 for the top one.
The real prize is feeling that tree and getting the sense of it.
You know, when owners say, hey, is this a champion? And I go, yeah, it is. They said, what do I get? I said, bragging rights. And a certificate from the Maryland Big Tree Program.
That's Jolie McCatherine, the vice chair of the Maryland Big Tree Program. Thank you so much and happy tree hunting.
Thank you, Scott.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. If you've been following the government shutdown debate, you might think that Democrats want to extend premium help for Obamacare health plans and Republicans don't want to, or at least not right now. NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin says there's at least one bipartisan group that is asking Congress for a quick approval of the credits, state insurance commissioners.
John Gottfried is the president of the National Association of Insurance Commissioners.
That's a membership body that has been in existence for 154 years, I think, at this point.
Every state and territory has a commissioner. Some are elected, others are appointed. Gottfried is the elected insurance commissioner of North Dakota. He's a Republican. When it comes to Congress extending the financial help for people who buy their insurance in the Affordable Care Act marketplaces or Obamacare, he says commissioners are united.
Red state, blue state, appointed, elected, whatever. We have unanimous approval of supporting these tax credits.
The insurance commissioners have been warning federal lawmakers about the fact that enhanced credits expire at the end of this year for months.
Since January, to be honest, I mean, I think we've sent four different letters. I spent just about the entire month of May in D.C. talking about these issues with different leaderships across different aisles and having the conversation.
He says since the premium credits were changed in 2021, more farmers and ranchers in his state have been able to buy coverage that's in their budgets. If Congress doesn't act, he says, they're going to be hit hard. On average, premiums will double, according to an analysis from KFF, a nonpartisan health policy research group. Some people's premiums will spike even more.
So you're looking at a family that maybe was paying $800 a month for their health insurance. All of a sudden, that jumps to $3,000.
According to KFF, more than 3 out of 4 people enrolled in these plans live in a state that President Trump won in 2024. Gottfried says when he talks with Republican lawmakers, sometimes they balk at the cost of the subsidies and how expensive premiums have become.
That discussion is separate. We can talk about the cost of healthcare and pharmaceuticals, all that pieces, but we still got to get access to consumers, and that's what these subsidies have helped provide.
He says at this point, health insurance carriers have locked in their rates for 2026. But there is still an opportunity to give consumers the subsidized rates if Congress acts quickly.
Most states, if not all states, had their carriers file two sets of rates, one with subsidies, one without. And so if they do a clean extension of these subsidies, I think most states will be ready to go on that.
The key, he says, is getting it done before November 1st, which is when open enrollment begins, so that consumers see a rate they can afford when they log in to shop for a plan. If they see their premiums have spiked, he says, he thinks they may drop their coverage and not come back. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News, Washington.
As cuts to federally funded food programs take effect, more and more people are turning to food pantries. Many of the volunteers who run the nation's emergency food pantries are aging, though, and there's a shortage of young volunteers.
The average age of our volunteers is probably about 75.
You can listen to that story on tomorrow's show, turn on your radio, or find us on the NPR One app. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingel. Support comes from Edge Center for the Arts in Big Fork, presenting Sketches of Minnesota, a civic community comedy tour on Saturday, October 11th. Doors at 5 p.m., dinner at 6. Open to all with registration required. Info at edgecenterarts.org. Adventures in Lifelong Learning continues its fall season every Tuesday at 10 a.m. at the Bemidji Eagles Club. Coffee and treats are served beginning at 9:40. There'll be a variety of speakers each week. Find a full schedule on Facebook. Look for Bemidji Adventures in Lifelong Learning. The City of Cohasset Parks and Rec Department offers woodsy walks at Tioga every Monday and Thursday at 1:30 p.m. Free and open to all. Meet at the Tioga Recreation Area parking lot. United Way of Bemidji will distribute coats for the community Saturday, October 11th from 9 to noon at First Lutheran Church on Bemidji Avenue North. Anyone in need of winter items are welcome. The McCrosty Arts Center in Grand Rapids hosts Family Create Second Saturdays with free family-oriented art activities for ages 4 and up. There's a new theme each month on the second Saturday from 1 to 3. Children under 12 must be accompanied by an adult. Trinity Lutheran Church on Highway 71 in Lake George has a lutefisk supper Saturday, October 11th from 4 to 7:30. They will also serve lefse, Swedish meatballs, pie, and more. The Buck Lake Improvement Club has a spooktacular breakfast buffet Sunday, October 12th from 9 to noon at the Buck Lake Community Center, 12 miles north of Nashwauk. Save a buck if you wear a costume. And the Heartland Symphony Orchestra performs Sunday, October 12th at 2:30 at the Geechee Zibi for the Arts. Free will donations accepted at the door. Find more info at heartlandsymphony.com.
All things considered from NPR News, I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly, and it is grape harvesting season for winemakers across the country. But with the world wine market sluggish these last few years, many in the U.S. industry say they are so backed up with unsold wine, they are dropping grapes to the ground or not harvesting them at all. As Anna King with Northwest Public Broadcasting reports, some say this is the worst year the wine industry has seen in decades.
Red Mountain in Washington is among the state's premier wine-growing spots. Sarah Goodhart watches as a hulking mechanical harvester straddles a row of grapes at her family's vineyard, Hedges Family Estate. It rattles the vines from both sides, and all her hard work drops onto a conveyor belt and then gets dumped on the ground.
It's wine that's never going to be made, and for a vintage as good as we're having this year, it's pretty painful.
Goodhart is the top winemaker here and has been through almost two dozen harvests, but this is the first year she's thrown fruit away. That's because her cellar is stuffed to the rafters with barrels of the previous 2 years of wine that haven't sold.
It's pretty typical to have the previous vintage in barrel during harvest, but not two vintages in barrel.
They're harvesting half of their grapes and dropping half. If they leave the fruit on the vine, she says the plants could be at a risk for fungus and diseases. Goodhart says they want to make sure the vines stay healthy so they can keep producing wine if the market comes back.
What everyone is saying in the industry is we're at the low of the low, and it's going to get better, and we're going to readjust.
The Hedges sales last year were down 13% from the year before, and they've cut about that in expenses and staff to keep solvent. Now, her family is having to dip into personal assets. This isn't just happening in Washington.
Today, the California wine industry is facing one of the most serious downturns that we've seen in decades, and it's not really because of one singular issue. It is a combination of challenges all hitting at once.
Natalie Collins is the president of the California Association of Wine Grape Growers based in Sacramento. She says the uncertainty of tariffs is causing uncertainty in the markets for one, and retaliatory measures from other countries have hit exports hard. But also over the past few years, she says global demand for wine has declined. In part, that's due to competition from other beverages like beers, ciders, seltzers, cocktails, NA drinks, and cannabis products, and increasing concerns about the health risks of drinking.
We're seeing new generations not drinking as much alcohol as past generations have.
She says that's led to an oversupply of wine globally. Some places are ripping out their vineyards or abandoning them. Meanwhile, on the East Coast, Chris King with the New York State Wine Grape Growers says he knows several vineyards that are very near to going out of business.
It's your neighbors. You feel their hardship, you feel their pain, and to see somebody who has put their life and their fortune and their dreams into this business and have it go away is just really sad to watch.
While right now the impact of the grape glut is mostly being felt by those in the wine industry, some think that eventually it could impact consumers. Adam Schultz runs the Incredible Bulk Wine Company in Washington State, which makes matches between winemakers and companies looking for bulk wine or grapes.
At some point, we're going to cross the threshold where there isn't enough bulk wine inventory, there aren't enough grapes in the ground.
He says that as more vineyards scale back, eventually the industry might resize so small that years from now, we might be looking at a wine shortage. For NPR News, I'm Anna King on Red Mountain in Washington State.
It's no joke when it comes to cheese in Wisconsin. The state would rank fourth in the world in cheese production if it was a country. So at a recent Art of Cheese Festival, big crowds showed up to celebrate and eat more than 100 Wisconsin cheeses. WUWM's Mayon Silver learned about all the nooks and crannies with a cheese expert and sent this postcard.
It's a gorgeous day outside at Cheese Fair off the square.
in an area near the Wisconsin State Capitol in Madison. People are lined up at cheesemaker's tents with tote bags and an appetite for dairy. Alicia Norris Jones is a cheesemonger. Like a sommelier offers advice about wine, she does the same with cheese. She rattles off some names of the cheese companies with displays.
Yeah, there's Pine River, we have White Jasmine, Alpenage Cheese Co., Foremost Farms. These are a lot of producers I actually haven't really encountered before.
She makes a beeline for the samples at the White Jasmine tent. The company says its cheese is where Eastern spice meets Midwest nice.
So I've been wanting to try your cheese for a while.
Owner Huma Siddiqui Seitz explains she's fusing cheese with the spices she grew up with in Pakistan.
This has our tandoori. This has 13 different spices in it. So lots of different flavors.
Norris Jones pops it in her mouth.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Also, this is incredible. Another tandoori today.
At another festival event held in a more rural area, people are gathering for lunch at a reclaimed dairy barn. There are all different kinds of cheeses, cheddars, Colbys, and blues, even a chocolate mascarpone. Norris Jones says she loves a variety, but she likes simplicity too.
I grew up with Kraft Singles, love cheese from day one.
And she wanted to expand her knowledge, becoming a certified expert. Now she's fluent in the language of cheese.
I have taken care of cheese from its like birth, as in like coming out of the creamery to your mouth. I try to bone up on cheese from every part of the world.
She has advice on how to approach a cheese festival.
So, number one, hydrate, lots of water. Cheese usually is accompanied by wine or a cocktail, so start there.
While Norris Jones guides guests through the cheese courses, Belinda Chang, a James Beard Award-winning sommelier, walks them through the wine pairings. Chang has a different way of tackling this cheese festival.
Instead of carbo loading, I've been Wisconsin cheese loading leading up to this big event. I imagine it's how they do it when they do the Coney Island hot dog challenge, just to get it in so your body is acclimated.
And you're nodding, Alicia. You're fully on board with that?
I really support the Kobayashi technique.
The next day, Norris Jones co-hosts a class called The Art of Pairing Cheese and Bloody Marys. She's picked out five types of cheese for the aficionados to pair with alcohol. For participant Linda Logan, the big hit was a buttery triple cream cheese paired with a Bloody Mary with beef broth.
I love the beef broth in here because it makes it heavy and rich, and then this is light and creamy. So I guess that's why it makes it a great pairing.
By the end of the class, the now educated cheese lovers are raucous and grateful.
To Alicia Norris Jones, thank you so much.
It's the art of cheese done the right way. For NPR News, I'm Ayan Silver in Madison.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from 20th Century Studios with Springsteen, Deliver Me From Nowhere, a pivotal chapter in the life of an icon, starring Jeremy Allen White and Jeremy Strong, in theaters October 24th. Tickets available now. From Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs, with online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com. From Odoo, maker of business management software with the goal of promoting growth and scaling businesses with efficiency. Learn more about Odoo at odoo.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. We receive support from Clockow Brewing Company in Grand Rapids, making traditional old world styles of beer as well as modern classics for 7 years now. Their taproom is open Monday through Saturday, noon to 8, Sunday from noon to 6. More info at clockoutbrewing.com. Weather tonight, mostly clear skies, lows in the upper 30s, areas of frost on the eastern Iron Range. Tomorrow, sunny, highs in the mid-50s.